You're listening to The Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 5th of January 2018 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily, in association with UBS. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to the Monocle Daily here on Monocle 24 with me, Paul Osborne. Coming up in the programme, it's the book that's got the world talking. Donald Trump hates it and wants it banned. That presumably is why it's selling so fast. We'll assess the fallout from Fire and Fury and ask how we can trust a book that's reliant on a fair few anonymous sources. Britain's government's drawing up a hit list for military budget cuts, and musicians might be in the firing line. Later on, we'll ask if that might be a mistake. Well, those bands often have to play national anthems, and we'll ask later on why some are so rousing and others downright dreary.
I spoke to some of the victims of the Bataclan attack, not victims obviously, but people who were there, and I was surprised by how moved they were still by the Marseillaise when...
Because, like we say, it's a tune that would get people stirred up in a way that God Save the Queen wouldn't.
Plus, we'll explore Finland's controversial new alcohol law and get an update on the big stories across Asia. All in the next hour on the Monocle Daily, live from London on Monocle 24. First, though, a quick look at some of the day's other top stories. France's president has told the leader of Turkey that there is no chance of his country joining the European Union. Emmanuel Macron criticised alleged human rights abuses in Turkey since a failed coup in 2016. But Tayyip Erdogan said he was tired of constantly imploring the EU to allow Turkey to join. Officials in South Korea say that North Korea has accepted an offer to attend high-level talks next week. The meeting will focus on trying to find a way for North Korean athletes to take part in next month's Winter Olympics in South Korea. The meeting will be the first high-level talks between the two Koreas since December 2015. A record-breaking cold snap is continuing across the east coast of North America. In parts of the US and Canada, temperatures fell as low as minus 29 Celsius. The extreme weather has so far been linked to 19 deaths in the US and 2 in Canada. And Apple has confirmed that all of its iPhones, iPads and Mac computers are compromised by major flaws in computer chips. It emerged earlier this week that tech firms are trying to fix two bugs that could allow hackers to steal customers' data. But Apple says there is no evidence that either vulnerability has been exploited. And welcome to tonight's Monocle Daily. To be honest, anybody who'd spent time in the White House and then written a book about the first year of the Trump administration could expect to sell a lot of copies. But when the president calls you a phony, threatens to sue, and then tries to stop the book from even being published, that is only going to help sales. In fact, Michael Wolff's Fire and Fury was published today, 4 days early, because of the furore around its extraordinary claims. And the author has not held back in defending his work. In a moment, we'll ask how you go about verifying claims in a book like this. But first, let's cross to Monocle's Washington correspondent, Sasha Eisenberg. Sasha, Michael Wolff said today that White House aides see Trump as a child who needs immediate gratification. And to be honest, the way he's responded to this book would kind of tend to back that up.
Yeah, I mean, this has been Trump's MO for as long as he's been a public figure going back to the 1980s in New York. He describes himself as a counterpuncher. He is all tactics, no strategy, elevates any sort of conflict, any disagreement into conflict at the highest level possible, and he likes legal threats. He has sued a lot of people over the years, but he has threatened to sue far more. And so this is the sort of playbook we've seen every day. You know, a senator says something moderately critical and Trump tweets insults at them, or a foreign leader does something that he finds undesirable and he lashes out. The odd thing is that Michael Wolff doesn't have, other than in certain media circles in the United States, pre-existing stature. And so Trump has obviously done plenty to elevate him. And the messages are a little confusing. He at once claims that the book is phony and filled with lies. And at the same time that the lawyers who threatened to try to stop Michael Wolff's publication of the book also told Steve Bannon to respect a non-disclosure agreement, which would seem to suggest that Bannon was actually offering something of insider knowledge that Trump has to fear. So, as is often the case with Trump, when he lashes out in a sort of childlike way, he does more to validate his critics than to undermine them.
Now, Trump said that Wolf wasn't given access to the White House, which presumably would be pretty easy to disprove just by looking at the visitor log. And as you say, says the book is full of lies. One wonders which claims in particular he says are not true, that the idea that his wife was in tears at the thought of her husband winning the presidency, or that there are people in the White House who think the president is at best semi-literate.
Sarah Huckabee Sanders was asked about this directly in the White House briefing yesterday, and she came up with one or two examples. One, a sort of widely derided anecdote in the book that suggested that Donald Trump doesn't know who John Boehner, the former House Speaker, is, that he didn't recognize the name, which sort of beggars disbelief given that Trump has tweeted not always favorably about Boehner on many occasions. He's gone golfing with the guy. And Sanders claimed that Wolf had gotten the ages of some White House staffers wrong. But none of the big charges in the book have been ones that have been addressed substantively. It was claimed by Wolf today and in some other reporting that the White House didn't even have a copy of the entire book until yesterday, and so that they were going off many of the same excerpts that the public had been. But there's not been a systematic effort to rebut these claims, and I think it's entirely evident that Wolf had plenty of access to the White House, both physically to the ground, to senior staff, a number of whom are quoted on the record or quoted verbatim in attributed quotes, and that he had some interactions with Trump, both as a candidate and as president.
While the specific comments may be new in the book, the central claim is hardly new, is it? Is that Trump is in a number of different ways temperamentally unsuited to being president?
No, I think if you got any journalists to cover this White House or spend time around it and freed them from all of the bonds of confidentiality that they have to their sources, permitted them to move on the record anything that had been told to them off the record or on background, allowed them to print things that they had heard speculated but not verified, things for which they had one source but not yet two, bits of gossip or conjecture. If you gave any White House reporter or well-sourced Washington journalist that mandate and told them to write as juicy a book as possible, I think they would have come up with something that's pretty close to what Wolf did. One of the big differences is, as he acknowledges in an author's note, he takes some liberties with material he's acquired in ways that I think, you know, would not be taught in journalism school. I'm not sure it makes the underlying material less true. I think it may make Wolf less trustworthy, but I think you come away from it and you have a portrait of the White House that is in no way at odds with what anybody familiar with the subject matter would tell you is the case. And, you know, as a lot of people have said, what's shocking is how not quite shocking some of these things about how, you know, immature, intellectually uncurious, reckless the president is.
And that's the thing, isn't it? The people who don't like Donald Trump are going to really enjoy reading this book because it's full of juicy tidbits about what an awful person Donald Trump is. But is it actually going to dent his popularity with the people who like him after everything that's happened in the last year?
Trump is, by any measure, unpopular. And it's worth saying this over and over again. You know, he is far less popular than any other president has been at this point in his presidency. He's shown no ability to expand his appeal beyond the sort of 35 to 40% who voted for him enthusiastically last fall. So the bigger question is, will this further impede his ability to expand that into something looking like a winning coalition? And then the other constituency that matters are congressional Republicans who have stood by Trump by and large with great loyalty because it's been in their political interest to do so. But they are looking ahead to what appear to be a very dismal midterm election season. And there may be a point where, especially if they lack confidence that Trump is, you know, a reliable steward of their agenda, that they walk away from him. And it's possible that this book gives a little more ballast to members of Congress who already sort of wonder whether Trump is somebody that they should be hitching their mid to long-term political ambitions to.
Monocle's Washington correspondent Sasha Eisenberg. Well, while the book is undoubtedly going to be an entertaining read, some reports have raised questions about the veracity of some of its claims and the techniques that have been used. When some of your sources simply can't be identified, how can you maintain the trust of readers? Well, let's talk to Gabriel Sherman, special correspondent at Vanity Fair and the author of a biography of the former head of Fox News called The Loudest Voice in the Room about Roger Ailes. If you're writing on a controversial subject, as you are and as Michael Wolff was, and you are reliant on interviews in some cases the people who can't be named, it is easy, isn't it, for the target of the criticism to just say, well, none of this is true. So how do you go about building up a defence in advance for when those allegations come back at you?
Well, I think, you know, I can only speak to my case in that I wrote a biography of Roger Ailes that was published in 2014 that relied in many cases on background sources. And what I tried to do to build trust with my readers was to be transparent. So my book contained voluminous endnotes in which I detailed every fact that was in a chapter of the book. I would indicate the sourcing, how I came to know that fact. And so readers could then, you know, verify and look at, I was, you know, transparent with exactly how I sourced the material, and they could make their own judgments as to the veracity of it. So I think in terms of investigative reporting, the only thing that journalists have are their integrity. And so you want to do as much as possible to preserve that with readers. I think in the case of Michael Wolff, and I agree with Sasha in this last segment, I think the substance and the fundamental takeaways from the book are undeniably true. I think what he's running into problems, though, is that the tactics and techniques by which Michael Wolff gained access to the White House by flattering Trump and writing favorable pieces and columns attacking the media and Trump's enemies, you know, that calls into questions his motives, and that he, on the one hand, would praise Trump and attack journalists and then turn around and turn on Trump himself. It was basically an ends justify the means style of journalism. And that, again, speaks to questions people have raised about Michael Wolff's ethics and approach. But again, I think that does not necessarily take away from the truth of the account he has written.
Well, certainly, one of his media interviews today in America, he was asked about how he had got in there. Had he used, you know, flattery? Had he been perhaps a little misleading? And he said, I did what I needed to do to get the story, which has obviously delivered him a book that's going to make him an enormous amount of money and make him very famous. But is that an ethical concern? At the same time, had you gone into Donald Trump's White House and said, I'm going to sit here and watch you for a year and write a warts and all account of what's going on, you would never have got past the front door.
Yeah, without question, you know. And so I think that is going to be something that, you know, journalism schools and the profession will have to reckon with. I mean, it's clearly not a style of journalism that I practice. And most other, you know, really working reporters that I know and respect practice. But that, again, does not take away from the public service value of the book he has written. You know, I think that speaks to sort of the controversial nature. And it does give credence to people who want to attack the book, who can call into question his character. I think the one thing Michael Wolff has going for him, and he kind of made this point in an interview on the Today Show, is that the credibility of his critics in the Trump White House is undeniably lower than his. So Trump's penchant for lying and dissembling is working in his favor, because people aren't going to really believe Trump's attacks either.
I mean, ultimately, in writing these kind of books, there's an awful lot of trust involved, isn't there? You need to trust that the people you're speaking to are telling you the truth. They need to trust that you're not going to expose them. And the people reading the book need to trust that, as you said when you detailed your fact-checking work, that you've done all you can to make the story as truthful as possible.
Yeah, and I think in Michael Wolff's case, I think he burned a lot of bridges in writing this book. I have spoken to people who were interviewed by him in settings that they understood to be strictly off the record. Their names were not to be used. The information was not to be used. And he just dumped all of that in reporting into his book. I mean, he clearly went into this project knowing that this was his one shot. And he went, you know, sort of went out in a classic blaze of glory. And it's, you know, he's done a public service by documenting this. But it, you know, clearly is going to hinder his future ability to write about the Trump White House and any other future, you know, subject that he potentially tackles, because, you know, I would be wary as a source dealing with him, given that he clearly seemed to have violated, you know, his prior agreements to write this book.
You must look at the amount of free publicity that Donald Trump's given him with a certain level of jealousy. I mean, if you wanted somebody to do a good job of plugging your book, you couldn't have had someone do a better job than Donald Trump the last couple of days.
Yeah, I mean, there is a part of Donald Trump that, you know, there's the only one thing worse than being attacked is being ignored. So by going on the offensive and, you know, elevating Michael Wolff, it has the sort of the other effect of keeping Donald Trump's name in the news. So either subconsciously or subconsciously, he is probably happy that Michael Wolff's book is doing very well, because that just means Donald Trump is going to remain in the headlines.
Gabriel, thank you very much. Gabriel Sherman is the author of that book on Roger Ailes called The Loudest Voice in the Room. You're listening to Monocle 24. Now, for months, there's been speculation about planned cuts to the UK's military. And one of the rumours is that Britain's military bands are in the firing line to protect, perhaps, part of the budget for frontline troops. It sounds like it might make economic sense, but is it necessarily a good idea? Well, let's get the views now of Elizabeth Brough, who's a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, who's been writing about this and joins me in the studio. So the Ministry of Defence reportedly is planning to cut more than a dozen of these military ensembles. And you can kind of understand it if the alternative is cutting army regiments or ordering fewer fighter jets.
Yes, you can, because musicians are not exactly needed in the armed forces. But then again, if you think about the value that they bring to the armed forces in public settings, they bring a lot of value. I mean, what would a royal wedding be without the trumpeters from the armed forces?
And internationally, there is that sense that it's the military bands that are there playing the national anthem when the foreign dignitary arrives. You say in Britain, I mean, the military bands are just associated with every ceremonial event that ever happens. So in terms of your image, your international image, they're quite powerful. They presumably deliver quite a lot for not a huge amount of money.
A lot of bang for the buck, you might say. yes, they do. And when you think about the sort of attractions that bring tourists to London in particular, what do people like to see here? Well, they like to see the change of the guards and the bearskins with their, both the soldiers and the musicians. So it's a huge asset to this country. And then when you look at other countries where they are less serious about music, and these public ceremonies that are televised and that we all see end up looking, making those countries look very, very silly indeed.
Well, indeed, and one that you've highlighted is Saudi Arabia, who are not shy about spending money on defence, but seemingly not that interested in music.
That's right. And so they spend about one-tenth of their GDP on defence. That's a huge percentage. For example, the UK is more around 2%, and the US is 3.4%. So, and that's, those figures are high in the sense of Germany spends 1.2%. So it's a huge percent of GDP that they spend on defence. But my point in this article was that if you're serious about your armed forces, you're also serious about your armed forces' music, and the level of musicianship mirrors the level of combat capability that your armed forces have. And in the case of Saudi Arabia, the musicians are not fantastic, and neither are the combat troops.
Now, the British Army, though, has, I think you say in your article, 22 separate musical ensembles. That's an awful lot. I mean, it does sound like they could probably lose a few without suffering too badly.
Yes, they could. The British Army alone, so we're not even talking about the Navy and the Air Force and the Royal Marines. The British Army has 7 symphonic wind bands, 6 multi-capacity wind bands, 3 brass bands, 3 pop bands, and 1 string orchestra. So you could make cuts to that. But then, of course, introduce this notion of music as being non-elemental to the armed forces, it gets this sort of second class status, and musicians might think twice about joining.
It's also the kind of thing that you can imagine the British tabloids getting worked up into an awful froth about. If you were a politician, and obviously there is a new defence secretary who's only been in the post for a few weeks in the UK, if you were a politician who was thinking about ways of cutting the military, if you wanted to guarantee you'd be on the front page of all the tabloids or doing something appalling and anti-British, then getting rid of British military bans is pretty much the dictionary definition.
Absolutely. And by the way, just as armed forces compete with each other, armed forces music is compared to other countries. Military music. So, for example, what if the UK were to cut its military music and the Russians had better musicians now? How would that look? And or even the North Koreans, who are very serious about military music, just as they are about their, combat capabilities.
I mean, I don't want to throw Brexit into the conversation. I mean, we sort of throw Brexit into more or less every conversation at the moment. But at a time when Britain's international position is, shall we say, in some flux, you would think you'd want to keep the things that make other countries like and respect you.
Exactly. And what are the things that make Britain famous in the world? I would argue primarily the armed forces, which are really world class and maybe not so much anymore, but used to be present all over the world. Now, if you cut that back to sort of, you know, medium-sized power dimensions, then Britain doesn't really have very much going for it in terms of international reputation anymore.
Well, we've also had reports, of course, in the last few weeks that this entire military review might be kicked into the long grass and delayed even more than we expected. So who knows when we'll find out. But for the moment, Elizabeth Brawl, thank you very much. And a little later in the programme, we're going to take a look at the national anthems those military bands play so often. We'll also find out why there's been something of a media frenzy about a change in the alcohol laws in Finland. Do stay with us.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Now, it's nearly 4 years since Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 set off from Kuala Lumpur for Beijing. It disappeared in March 2014 with 239 people on board. A 1,000-day hunt that cost more than $100 million turned up nothing. But now a survey ship's heading to the spot where it is thought the plane's wreckage lies, and its owners are confident of success. Well, let's get more from Professor Guy Grattan, who's an aerospace engineer and visiting professor at Cranfield University. Thank you very much for joining us. Why are the owners of this new survey ship so confident that they can find the plane when nobody else has been able to?
It looks like they're working from the enormous amount of data that was created from the previous search, which covered 46,000 square miles. And of course, there's been a year since they ceased the previous search, and all of that year has been available for anybody to reanalyze all of the data. That's led to the lead agency, which is the Australian Transportation Safety Bureau, identifying what they think is about 10,000 square miles, so about 100 by 100 miles, where they are very confident the wreckage is. Of course, they don't know for certain. So essentially, they've got much better information because they're working from everything before. They've narrowed it down to what they believe is the right area. In addition to that, they've put together quite an impressive set of hardware. This Norwegian ship, the Seabed Constructor, is carrying 6 2-ton, essentially swimming robots. They are completely autonomous, computer controlled. They can go right down to about 4 kilometers below the surface. And about 6 kilometers below the surface, 4 miles, and basically do the search on their own. And every few days they will come up, upload all of the data. And it's an order of magnitude more capability into a smaller area than existed before. So the chances have got to be good.
They've only got a very limited time, though, haven't they, compared to how long some of the other searches were given. There is this big paycheck on offer from Malaysia if they can find the wreckage, but they've got about 90 days.
Well, the rate they believe they can search, that 90 days would be enough to, in theory, to repeat the whole previous search. But of course, they aren't doing that. They're down into this narrower area. So, I mean, they've had access to all of this data, which I haven't, but they must have a great deal of confidence from having seen it that the wreckage of MH370 really is down there in that 10,000 square miles.
Now, a lot of people, you know, were amazed that this previous search, as we say, cost about $100 million, wasn't able to turn up any trace of the plane. But it really is an extraordinarily difficult task.
It is. I mean, to put this in perspective, this aeroplane weighed about 300 tons. So it's an aluminium tube, about 60 meters long. Well, assuming it's at the bottom of that area of ocean, it's about 4 miles down in on a seabed that nobody, well, they have now mapped, because that's what they've done as part of this search. In fact, I understand they found four completely unknown shipwrecks while they were down there as well.
That's extraordinary.
It is, absolutely. But to looking for that in an area that's roughly speaking the size of the British Isles, I mean, that is quite an undertaking. Because when you see a funny shaped lump down there, four miles down, is that simply a funny shaped lump, or is that aircraft? Because you've got no previous mapping to compare it to.
Now, you mentioned that those drones and the capacity they have to basically autonomously do this search and then report back. So do you think they've got a decent chance of actually finding the wreckage?
I certainly very much hope they do. They certainly do, because this expedition must be costing quite a few millions of pounds. And as I understand it, they're on a no fine, no fee arrangement with the Malaysian government. So if they don't find it, they're out of pocket by an enormous lump of money. But also, we really want to know the answer to this. I mean, 239 people missing. I think we can assume, sadly, they're all dead. And we have no real idea what happened to them. And I fly on airliners regularly. I'm sure you do too, and most of your listeners do. We want to know how this happened so that we can make sure it doesn't happen again. And until we have an idea of how it happened, there is that huge question mark in aviation safety that makes nobody at all happy.
Well, it's fascinating. So the search ship is due to arrive in the next few days, so we'll wait to see how those underwater drones do. For now, though, Professor Guy Gretton, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Monocle 24. Now, a little earlier in the programme, we talked about the soft power potential of military bands, and often they are called upon to perform the visiting dignitary's national anthem. But what makes a good national anthem, and why are other ones, frankly, so very dreary? I'm well aware I say that, being someone from Britain. To discuss this, Andrew Muller is joined by the author and broadcaster Clemency Burton Hill and the journalist Alex Marshall, who starts by assessing how just changing the arrangement of an anthem can send a strong political message.
Jimi Hendrix at Woodstock, of course, with the Star Spangled Banner. Alex, you have looked into national anthems, the art and science thereof, more than most people. Are they especially useful arenas for people wishing to satirize or subversify and so forth. You have a fixed point like the Star Spangled Banner, and you can therefore, as Hendricks did, leverage it into some sort of abstruse protest against the Vietnam War.
I think, you know, you only have to look at what's been going on in American football for the past, you know, 18 Indeed months so. To see how, you know, what a vibrant area anthems still are. It's a shame people don't do so many covers. Like, the last great cover of the Star Spangled Banner I can think of was by Marvin Gaye. He turns it into this beautifully sexy soul song, and you've got no idea whether he is satirizing it or if he's just high.
And it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It's just wonderful.
And I almost wish more people would take those songs and mock them. The people who do it most at the moment are in Eastern Europe, and that's more where there's a sort of highly charged political environment.
And you know what I find really disturbing is that I feel like if people were to satirise, say, the national anthem in this country now, it would, in this very febrile political atmosphere, worryingly, I think that would really have a... It would be shocking. People would embrace... It would start being some sort of Brexit comment or vice versa. And, you know, previously, I think Britons, we were brilliant at satirising our own culture, but somehow, as a reflection of where we are politically today, I worry that that would have an impact that it wouldn't have done a few years ago. Even.
Clemency, your invocation there of the national anthem, or indeed anthems of this country, does lead me to something else I wanted to talk about, which is the countries, and I think this country is one of them, my own country, Australia, is another, where and there's an anthem in waiting. There is a superior option available, which for whatever reason has never quite happened. Now, God Save the Queen, which is the national anthem of the United Kingdom, is anyone going to disagree that it's just a dirge?
It's a non-national anthem.
It's a bit on the solemn side, isn't it?
And it's also, it's not about the country. It's about somebody.
It's one of the few anthems that doesn't even say our hills look nice. I mean, you know, it could at least tick that box.
The various of the home nations of the United Kingdom have their own songs, of course. Scotland does, Wales does, which I know is an obvious favourite of yours, John.
And mine.
Oh, right. And yes, right.
I definitely claim the Welsh blood in me when it comes to Land of My Fathers.
But what I wanted to do was the compare and contrast. God Save the Queen, which is a damn squib, and does it not share the melody with the national anthem of Liechtenstein?
Everywhere
as well?
It still does.
But there is, of course, Jerusalem, England have that option and have as yet not availed themselves of it. So I want to play God Save the Queen first, which of course goes like this. God Save the Queen, of course, versus Jerusalem. Blake, as arranged by Parry, if I remember rightly.
It's just incomparable, isn't it?
I mean, it is fantastic, is it not? And Clemency, is an anthem that important? Would it make a difference to the psyche of England if instead of this dreary, subservient dirge, which is currently the British national anthem, England embraced this mad, mystical, dizzying, wondrously arranged poem?
Well, there's part of me that is concerned about the idea that our national identity is bound up in anything, because I think, as I was just referring to, you know, I'm worried about that kind of direction in the way that our political discourse is going. Same thing as a flag, really. You know, these things can become instruments of the state. And personally, as a Brit, I'm very proud of the fact that I haven't felt in the years in which I've been on this planet that we are that kind of nation, and I really am concerned that we might be heading more into that direction. However, I do think there's a lot to be said for just the cracking music. I mean, Parry is a legit classical composer. Mm-hmm. He absolutely, his word setting with that Blake poetry is among, you know, a great example of what you can actually do when you put a wonderful poem with fantastic music. So from that point of view, of course, the person in me that wants, you know, everyone to embrace better music wherever possible would love that to be our national anthem.
If we think about the Marseillaise, I mean, after the Paris attacks, you know, everyone was singing it and singing it spontaneously, and then it became sort of co-opted by the government. And there were, I found something very inspiring by that. And I spoke to some of the victims of the, you know, in the Bataclan attack, not the victims, obviously, but people who were there, and people who were immigrants. And I was surprised by how moved they were still by the Marseillaise.
Like we say, it's a tune that would get people stirred up in a way that God Save the Queen wouldn't. I mean, you know,
but
you know,
when we've had attacks, no one's gone.
Yeah. Sings God Save the Queen.
And I have always thought if we changed it, would people reach for that a song? But on one level, our reaction to those attacks in the UK has been inspiring enough that we don't really need a song to unite.
It also depends where you are, and I suspect that if it was in Liverpool, God forbid, you know, it would be You'll Never Walk Alone. It will be something that has more cultural relevance to that particular locality, I suspect.
Clement C. Burton Hill and Alex Marshall talking to Andrew Muller about national anthems. Andrew, very dismissive of the British national anthem, which is a little rich coming from an Australian. Anyway, this week's episode of The Foreign Desk is all about national anthems. To find out which one was crowned the winner, you can listen tomorrow from midday London time or any time after that at monocle.com. Now, it's at this point in the programme that we would normally get an update from one of our contributors in a city around the world about how they plan to spend their weekend there. This week, however, slightly differently, we're off to the Alps, where waiting for us is Monocle's Jessica Bridger. First of all, what are you doing there?
After 20 years of not skiing, I am relearning how to ski as an adult.
So what happened after 20 years to make you decide it was time to relearn?
I ended up working a lot out of Zurich. So I figured, you know what, it's time to learn how to ski. A lot of the people I work with ski. So it's time to do it.
So exactly whereabouts are you?
So I'm in Davos Kloosters, and I'm in Kloostersdorf, which is a small ski town, or it's a ski village. And it's very cute, and it has over 773 kilometers of ski trails in the area, so in this larger region. But in my area, it has a very cute hill for beginner skiers.
Ah, okay. So it's the ideal environment to relearn.
Yes.
Now, one thing, I have to put my cards on the table early on here. I am not a skier. I have never gone skiing, and honestly, I'm not sure I ever will. We'll get on to the bits of it, the culture that I've always been a bit more interested in a minute. But one of the things I've always thought about is, how on earth do you get around? Because it's not exactly car friendly.
No, it's not. Especially this year when we've had a lot of snow and we just had a large storm on Thursday. But what there is there's a lot of local public transit, and a lot of the hotels even give you a pass, which lets you use all of that transit for free. So you can go from restaurant to restaurant, from ski area to ski area, from friends' chalet to your hotel for free on the wonderful Swiss transit from bus to train.
Now, you mentioned hotels there, and that decision is pretty important, particularly when your days of presumably your days of ski lessons are pretty hard work. You need a decent hotel to come back to afterwards.
Ideally one with a sauna. And you've got a lot of options. There's everything from, the Swiss have been very good about keeping their grand hotels intact. There's the Waldhaus Sils, for example, in Sils Maria, which is a wonderful option if you're skiing St. Moritz or Pontresina. There are these networks of smaller hotels. I'm staying in one where it's these family-run hotels, which are part of larger groups. So you can kind of move around within them, but you get that personal feeling. And all of them have this kind of Swiss pine interior, which has this wonderful fragrance and easy connections to all the skiing you want.
Now, as I said a moment ago, I have never been the world's biggest fan of skiing, though I have occasionally said to friends of mine that who were planning skiing holidays, I'd go with them and just hang around in the chalet. The après-ski thing always seemed quite appealing. So I mean, I would be in the market for a few bar or restaurant ideas.
Yeah, here in Graubünden, you've got a lot of options. You've got everything from the cult classic La Baraka in San Moritz, which is turns into basically a nightclub. The owners love AC/DC, but they have everything from hip hop and techno to kind of classic rock bands actually come and play there. But then there's also many, many mountain restaurants that have excellent food. Here in Klosters, there's one that's a little bit outside of town called the Berghaus Appenrösli. And this has excellent food, Gautmalo points, and they'll lend you a sled if you decide you want to go sledding post your hearty lunch.
Right, so 20 years passed before you decided it was time to learn to ski again. I'm assuming 20 years will not pass before you return.
No, it won't, especially as I found out that many friends own houses in the area. So hopefully they'll be more likely to give me an invitation, although many of the people who take things very seriously here end up buying in some of the smaller towns and villages, and then they end up going ski touring, which is multi-day off-piste adventures, which maybe I'll be ready for 20 years from now.
Well, those houses sound awfully convenient. Thank you very much to Monocle's Jessica Bridger, learning to ski again in the Swiss Alps. In just a moment, we'll take a look at some of the top stories across Asia. Do stay with us.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
They've reported, listened, watched, quizzed and cajoled. They've been to farms and galleries, conclaves and bars. They've reported from the high north and tropical metropolises. And you? Well, all you need to do is turn the dial, click our app or pop in your headphones and head off on an audio tour of the spikiest, juiciest, funniest moments from Monocle 24's week that was. The Curator is our one-hour show that informs, entertains and surprises with the best bits of all our magazine shows, from The Urbanist to The Menu, The Stack to The Entrepreneur's Culture to Section D, premiering live every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time. You can also subscribe to the programme at monocle.com or on iTunes or on SoundCloud to ensure that you never miss a beat. Come on, let's catch up this weekend. Listen to The Curator.
Well, it's time now to take a look at some of the top stories across Asia. And my guest in the studio this evening is Bruno Garces, who is the BBC World Services digital editor for East Asia. Thank you very much for coming in. Let's begin with the fallout from Donald Trump's criticism of Pakistan. We started by talking about this book all about Donald Trump. Before that emerged, we were talking about these tweets that he sent about Pakistan. Then the US announced yesterday that it was going to suspend security cooperation. This has had a bit of an impact in China.
Yes, I think the unexpected effect of Trump saying that the U.S. has foolishly given Pakistan more than $33 billion in aid over the last 15 years and calling and saying that Pakistan has done nothing but lies and deceit and harboring terrorists and all, is that it brought Pakistan closer to China. It's interesting that Pakistan was somewhat reluctant to fully embrace the Belt and Road Initiative, which is quite a big project that China is pushing for throughout the whole region, with infrastructure works involving all the neighboring its neighboring nations, and which somewhat replicates the Silk Road of the past. And because it also had a big bill for Pakistan to pay. But Pakistan has already shown that, given Trump's bellicose rhetoric, it has allowed the use of Chinese currency for bilateral trade and investment activities, something that the central bank had been very reluctant in doing. But almost overnight like this, it just adopted this measure. And previously, Pakistan had pulled out of a mega dam project, which would be done in coordination with China, citing these tough financial conditions that I had mentioned. So now, if Pakistan is to feel more isolated, it is most likely to get closer to China.
And it's interesting, isn't it? Because China talked about wanting to expand its influence in the region. Indeed, in the New Year message out of China was talking about how it would take a more strident position, talk more about its, give Beijing's view on big international issues. Everybody said that's because Donald Trump's disengaging around the world. And here he is doing exactly what they thought. And yet the US talks about China and Russia being rivals for international influence and then seems to do something that plays into the hands of those countries.
Yeah, it's the jiu-jitsu in which he plays against himself, apparently.
Yes, Donald Trump, one of the world's great thinkers, seems to be the theme of this evening's programme. Let's move on to South Korea, because restrictions there on teaching English to young children haven't gone down well necessarily with those children's parents.
Yes, precisely. Those the government has announced the decision to ban public kindergartens and elementary schools from teaching English before grade three. That is, that daycare centers, which receive kids from the ages of 3 to 6, should not be teaching English. That's not necessarily some particular view that would hamper their education in some way. It's more a means to standardize the education in the country so that English is provided when it is adopted in the traditional curriculum. However, what parents found is that it was a top-down decision in which parents were not consulted in any shape or form.
And presumably, it's reasonably popular with parents because there is, this sounds terribly arrogant coming from an Englishman, but there is that idea that learning English is generally a pretty useful thing. And we all know that the sooner you start learning a second or third language, the better you're going to be at it.
Yes, in particular in a country which is very cosmopolitan and very outward-looking, such as South Korea, and which somewhat distinguishes itself from Japan in that respect, where people who have full domain of English are somewhat limited, and it's something of a newer generation in Japan. South Korea, the new generation tends to speak, at least in more affluent areas and so forth and so on, especially in Seoul, are very fluent in English and have full domain of it.
It's interesting you mentioned the top-down thing. That is the thing that's really annoyed the parents, this idea that the government just issues a decree, as it were, that changes the way that their children are being educated. But I suppose that's how all governments have control of education. They determine the curriculum.
Yes, that's the thing. That's what the point made by the government. It's that it's no draconian law. It's just the way that they want the educational curriculum in the country to be.
Now, let's finally turn to the continuing search for a former Thai prime minister who it is widely believed is, maybe closer than we think to this very studio.
Yes, that's true. She was spotted in the former prime minister, Yingluck Shinawatra, who was supposedly spotted for the second time in a very short span of time in close to Harrods here in central London.
It's always Harrods, isn't it?
Yes.
The allure of Harrods.
Yes, yes. Apparently Yingluck does enjoy her bling, so that's a normal hangout that we would expect her to be.
When you consider that the Venezuelan embassy is a million miles away from Harrods, and I mean, I'm not suggesting that you should necessarily endorse or support the idea of snatching Yingluck Shinawatra off the streets in London, but if that was your aim, I would have thought, without doing too much detective work, that if you hung around outside Harrods for long enough, there was a reasonable prospect that you were going to see her.
Well, I think that this cat and mouse game, there is a little bit of a theater to it. I would think that the authorities probably keep a tail, and they have a bit of an idea where she is or where she might be. They have been, you know, on the following her and her brother, who the other ousted prime minister, Thaksin Shinawatra, for quite a while. He alternates his time between here, London, Dubai, and Hong Kong, and I think probably she has a similar itinerary to her brother.
And it probably helps, doesn't it, if you're the current rulers of Thailand, to have a couple of kind of totemic figures that you can point to, saying, "Ah, you see how much they care about the ordinary people of Thailand as they hang around outside this very expensive department store on the other side of the world." That probably doesn't hurt.
No, not at all. I mean, these are two characters that do, well, one, they are extremely rich people still, although they've had some of their assets taken from them, but they enjoy the high life as well, and it plays down quite well into the narrative that the Thailand military government has been playing by portraying them as foes, as people out of touch with reality. But having said all that, the two of them still have a something of a popular support in Thailand, which is why they are feared as well by the military.
Bruno, I'll have to leave it there, but thank you very much for coming in this evening. Bruno Garces is a digital editor at the BBC World Service. You're listening to Monocle 24. Now, here in London, it's getting fairly late now on a Friday evening. Indeed, the first Friday of 2018, the first few days back at work after the holidays. And as I head home from the studio, I may well treat myself to a small alcoholic reward. Nothing too extreme, obviously. And had I been in Finland right now, my options in the past would have been rather limited. But now the country's grocers are allowed to sell stronger alcoholic drinks. The first time they've been allowed to do that since the 1960s. But the change has been controversial. Well, joining me in the studio to tell all on this is our resident Finn here at Monocle, Marcus Hippie. Marcus, so for 50-odd years, there have been these restrictions on the strength of the alcoholic drinks you can sell in a supermarket. Why?
Well, actually, if you look at what was going on even earlier on, alcoholic drinks were not allowed to be sold at all. So we've been going to a more liberal direction. But
it's progress, just very slow.
Exactly, very slow. I guess the question is about the mentality in Scandinavia, even more widely, not just Finland. It's also the same thing in Norway and Sweden, for example. But there's always this worry of how people are going to be drinking if they can buy stronger drinks, and are they going to destroy their healths by boozing too much? And it's been a bit patronizing, I would even say, but now there's been gradually a stronger sentiment by the public, thinking that, you know, we travel to other countries and we see that people in other countries are fine, even though if they can buy stronger drinks from shops. So that's what's been happening. So earlier this week, for the first time in 50 odd years, it was allowed to sell stronger alcoholic drinks in grocery stores or even at gas stations, as you mentioned. It's not a massive difference. So earlier on, you were able to buy beer, for example, that was 4.7% strong in maximum. But nowadays, the new limit is 5.5%. So it's not a massive difference, but there's been a lot of controversy and there's been an amazing amount of media attention as well. It was quite interesting to follow what was going on the 2nd of January when these shops opened and people were coming into these shops. All media was following what's happening in Finland. There were loads of reporters trying to see what type of beer Finnish people are buying, and that's probably one of the biggest news stories of the year in Finland, that you can actually buy beer that's not only 4.57%, but 5.5%.
So this is all alcohol. The new limit is 5.5% alcohol content. So you can't buy a bottle of wine in a supermarket in Finland.
I love how upset you sound by that, but that's my reality. That's where I come from, and I find it equally bizarre now that I've been living away from Finland for so long. But the fact is, let's imagine that you are organising a lovely dinner party for your friends on Sunday evening, and then you wake up on Sunday morning, you realise that you actually haven't remembered to buy any wine. You are in trouble. There is no legal way of buying wine in Finland on Sundays. You can try to call your friends.
How has there not been a violent uprising against this law?
Well, it's interesting. I was checking out the latest statistics. There was a poll amongst the Finnish public just to see how they feel about the alcohol legislation. And I think Finns are quite satisfied with the way things have been so far. So according to this, about half of Finns were quite happy with the previous legislation. One third of them wanted to loosen the rules, and there was actually 1 in 10% actually wanted to have stricter rules on alcohol sales. But interestingly enough, at the same time, for some reason, it seems like they thought of wine as a totally separate category. Half of Finns wanted to have wines in grocery stores.
Well, if you say, in a way, Finland's going against the tide here by loosening alcohol restrictions, because a lot of countries are actually trying to make it harder to buy, particularly stronger alcoholic drinks, because they're concerned about things like binge drinking.
Finland is coming from the other extreme. Remember that sales of alcohol have been incredibly limited. Basically, anything that's stronger than 5.5% now belongs to the state alcohol monopoly.
Well,
alcohol
is
selling that all.
You can buy stronger drinks. It's just you can only buy them
and
from this chain of government-approved
exactly,
stores.
But at the same time, buying that stronger alcohol is not always that easy, because the opening times are relatively limited still, and these shops are closed on Sundays. So you have to remember to do your shopping by 6, 7pm on Saturdays, for example.
So how did, I mean, I don't want to make this too personal, but how did you go through your teenage years? It's a rite of passage in Britain for a teenager to go into a supermarket and sneak out with a bottle of wine or something. I mean,
it was a bottle of lame
not
beer.
Not that strong
exactly,
beer.
Exactly. That was, yeah, we're not that raunchy in the Nordic region, it seems. Anyway, I just want to make a point that there's been a massive traffic between Finland and Estonia. Finns have been going to Estonia to buy stronger alcohol for cheaper prices. And one of the reasons also why this stronger beer is at grocery stores now is that it's hoped that people would actually buy more beer from Finland instead of going to Estonia. So that would bring more tax money. But also, it's interesting that there's been a big concern. For example, the Interior Ministry was thinking that they should invest more money on police resources just before this week, because they were worried that Finland is going to turn into Sodom and Gomorrah, because people are going to be able to buy beer that's
they've
about...
They've got a 0.8% increase in the alcohol content
exactly.
of beer.
But that's a great example of how... What a weird paranoia there is still in Finland when it comes to alcohol consumption. But I think when people travel more and go to other countries, I think the mentality is going to get a bit more relaxed gradually. At least that's what I hope for.
Well, Marcus, you have the advantage of being in London, where, of course, strong alcohol is practically compulsory.
Exactly. And I have to admit that when I first moved here, I was rather excited by the idea of being able to buy wine and beer basically any time of the day, any day. But that novelty kind of wears off gradually, and you start taking things for granted until you go back to your home country, Finland.
You can't buy wine in a Finnish supermarket. If that isn't a revelation to end a programme, I don't know what is. Markus Heppi, thank you very much for enlightening us on the curious state of Finland's alcohol laws. That wraps up this Monocle Daily, which Markus produced. He's been awfully busy today, probably has earned a drink. Our researcher to Daphne Karnesis and Katie Mendoza, our studio manager, Sarah Miles. Georgina Godwin will be here for the weekend edition. That starts in 9 hours at 8 a.m. London time on Saturday morning. And this programme, the Monocle Daily, is back at 2200 on Monday. For the moment, though, from me, Paul Osborne, thanks for listening. Goodbye and have a great weekend.